Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it was the recent headline of an AP article that caught my attention. Bacon may disappear in California as pig rules take effect. Let me explain. At the start of next year, 2022, the state of California will begin enforcing an animal welfare proposition that was approved overwhelmingly by voters there back in 2018. This proposition requires more space for breeding pigs, egg-laying chickens, and veal calves. Now, veal and egg producers around the country are optimistic they can meet these new standards. But not so for pork producers. Only 4%, just 4% of hog operations now comply with the new California rules. So unless something changes, California will lose almost all of its pork supply, and much of that comes from Iowa. Remember, our state is the number one producer of pork and hogs in the country. So this half hour, three perspectives on the debate surrounding animal welfare as it pertains to raising hogs and the potential impact of these California rules on Iowa's pork industry. In a few minutes, we'll hear from an Iowa hog farmer and also a representative of Nyman Ranch. But first, Colin Johnson is with us. He's a swine specialist at Iowa State University Extension. Colin, welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me. Look forward to the discussion about some very important issues to consumers and producers alike.
Exactly. Tell us a little bit more about Proposition 12. What are the new rules for pork to be sold in California as of 2022?
The referendum that occurred in 2018 and passed by voters there, it's titled the Prevention of Cruelty to Farm Animals Act. And, in the title, obviously, that sounds great. Nobody wants to have cruelty to our livestock or any animals by no means. You know, maybe a little bit conceiving when you, if you were to read all the language that was written into that act, really goes above and beyond the industry standards that we have today and kind of constrains, obviously, as you mentioned, the supply. If only 4% of our farms right now are running the square footage requirements that California is going to ask of us, then the supply to California is really going to be very tight. And in all honesty, it's truly not 100% welfare directed and oriented, these square footage requirements, because welfare ultimately comes down to a housing and a sheltering. And then number one is just stockmanship and daily care.
So as I'm reading it, confined in a cruel manner, according to this proposition, at least in one parameter, is defined as with less than 24 square feet of usable floor space per pig. I wonder if you can give us a sense of the debate over what qualifies as pigs confined in a cruel or humane manner. Does that differ from state to state? What can you tell us there?
It's moving that direction by state to state, and actually, number one, it's a lot of times it's retailers driving some of these changes, whether it was the cage-free individually housed hens, where McDonald's or, you know, the big grocer suppliers and others were requesting this across the country. But the other thing is that it starts on the coast where people are removed from the vast majority of livestock production country, so they don't understand. And in part, from an industry standpoint, maybe we need to look at it and say, well, yeah, modern barns that we have erected to provide for the pigs on an individual basis, to shelter them from climate changes, a daily weather issue, hot and cold. Parasites, you know, predators, things like that, and where we can feed them individually. We've done a good job of creating farms and barns that allow us to manage, provide for those individual pigs or hens or even cattle on a daily basis. But when someone drives by a barn or you see it on a TV or a computer and it's a barn, you can't see what's going on in there, right? It's very closed up. So they think we might be hiding something.
Colin, just on that point, too, with good reason to think that we hog producers may be hiding something, because we have now many years of increasingly restrictive, they're known as ag gag laws, that make it really a severe penalties, a crime, to videotape inside one of these to reveal what may be happening in some of these installations, right?
True. And the other point along with that is biosecurity. You know, we want to keep our livestock as healthy as can be, and so we very much limit visitors and traffic near livestock operations. It's so, so critical. I always say, if you don't have health in your livestock barn, or even as an individual, you know, think of the COVID pandemic, if you're not protecting the herd, protecting yourself, it can get very, very costly, and that's a major welfare issue.
In the time we have, tell us briefly about the actions trying to stop this. There's a court case. The Iowa pork producers last week argued in federal court that this California animal confinement law would result in, quote, irreparable economic harm to Iowa farmers. Also, Senators Grassley and Ernst co-sponsored, and it's called Exposing Agricultural Trade Suppression Act. It would prohibit state and local governments from creating laws regarding the production and manufacture of agricultural goods from other states that exceed existing federal, state, and local regulations. So what do you see as the chance of this being stopped in the legal sense?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wouldn't have a great answer on that. And what the basis there is really the challenge to the Interstate Commerce Clause. And so far, that's been ineffective, and they're allowing California to proceed with this. And so it'll be interesting on January 1. I mean, what kind of supply can we get to California in this short time? Even though it was voted in 2018, it's been a slow release of how the rules would be implemented. Because if you think, our biggest challenge is, we're up to, you know, all the changing production systems. If the consumer wants to pay it and require it, agriculture is great at adapting. And so we'll meet that. We won't need to meet that with the whole industry. But in order to supply pork on January 1 by these requirements, you have to realize that it's 6 months of growing the pig and finishing and processing and distribution, plus it's nearly 4 months of breeding, 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days, or 114 days is our gestation period. So those sows, those females would have had to been bred, we're tracking back nearly a year prior to January 1.
Colin Johnson, swine specialist with Iowa State University Extension, thank you for your view on this. This is a story we'll watch, and there are many views on it. But in the meantime, Colin, thank you for giving us some time from I think your summer vacation still. Take care.
Yep, thank you as well for the opportunity to visit on the industry.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you've just joined us, talking about the fact that the state of California will begin enforcing an animal welfare proposition that was passed there overwhelmingly by voters in 2018, requiring more space for breeding pigs. That's what we're talking about in this case, because only 4% of hog operations now comply with those new California rules. And unless something changes, California will lose almost all of its pork supply, and many hog producers here in Iowa will lose that major market. Let's get two other perspectives on this. Mike Postian is with us, a hog farmer based in Walcott, Iowa, eastern Iowa. Mike, I understand you're at the Iowa State Fair. You found a quiet place, so welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much. Yeah, I don't know that there is a quiet spot at the state fair, but
we'll give it a shot.
Found as good a one as I can. I'm actually at the pork tent serving pork chop on a stick to all the hungry Iowans who are here at the fair today.
Very good. Mike is also the former president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association, besides being a hog farmer. Chris Oliviero is with us as well, general manager with Nyman Ranch. Chris, welcome to you.
Ben, thanks for having me on the program.
Those not familiar with Nyman Ranch will need a very brief explanation about the philosophy in raising cattle that Nyman Ranch stands for.
Sure. Nyman Ranch is a both pork, beef and lamb company. We support 750 farmers and ranchers, throughout the Midwest in particular. About 650 raise hogs for us. The pork program at Nyman was founded in 1995 by Paul Willis. We call him hog farmer number one. And from the beginning, our program has been based on a philosophy that, gestation crates and farrowing crates are not necessary. We view, true gestation crates as something that's challenging from an animal welfare standpoint. Since 1995, our sows, per our protocols, get 35 square feet. Certainly above what Prop 12 is pushing, different from the rest of the industry as well.
Right, and so this Prop 12 does not affect your operations. You're above that standard, is what I'm getting from you, Chris. Back to Mike Postian, tell us, what is the potential impact of this California proposition, these new rules? What does it have on impact on your operation and other hog farmers like you, which I assume is the majority here in Iowa?
Yeah. It's great to have a good, vigorous public discussion about animal welfare. I think it's important. Though I think one thing that gets left out of the conversation is that it's kind of a moving target. I've been raising pigs my whole life. My dad's been raising pigs for over 60 years, and we've done it differently over those years, and we probably will do it differently in the future as we learn new things and find new ways to care for animals and keep them healthier. And that's the number one priority. But I think the way this is happening with the proposition in California has kind of created a lot of turmoil just because of the way that it's happening. I think we've been talking about animal welfare and how we can do better for many, many years. And, that's part of the pork quality assurance program that every producer, every person who works with pigs has to be certified. And every site, every barn that holds pigs has to be certified in that program. But now we've had California say, well, here's the new standard that everyone has to follow. And, the reality is that's going to, potentially cost millions and millions of dollars for producers to change their facilities that don't meet those standards right now. And really the worry as I talk to other producers is, well, okay, so we spend all this money to comply with California's rule. Well, then what if Oregon comes out next year and says, okay, now we have a new rule that everyone has to follow?
Right, Mike. But to push back on that a little bit, doesn't every state, whether it's Oregon or California or Iowa, the California voters have decided these are the standards for the pork to be sold in their state? I mean, are you saying that they don't have the right to define that? The fact that it's a huge market is another thing, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. By all means. No, by all means, the voters in California have the right to, decide however they, if they want all pigs to have manicures and have their toenails painted, they can certainly make a rule on that. But then it's up to the marketplace to then determine if producers are going to be willing to meet that requirement. Right. And that's where I'm hearing most of the hesitancy from producers. Certainly there will be some that see that as an opportunity. And the folks at Neiman Ranch, obviously they don't have to change anything that they're doing right now. And that's a great opportunity for them to sell into that market. But, there are a sizable number of producers who are concerned that if they make the investment to meet those requirements, they might not see enough return from that to pay for that investment. And mm-hmm. and that's really what the concern is, just kind of the uncertainty surrounding it right now.
Right. Chris, back to you. We heard from our swine specialist of ISU a few minutes ago about how a lot of changes towards animal welfare have been driven by consumers in other areas. Where do you see your growth? You're obviously in a niche there that depends on people placing a very high standard on animal welfare and are willing to pay more for the meat and so forth for it. Where do you see the main drivers here as this changes?
Yeah, no, great question. You know, the first thing I want to say is that I believe strongly that, you know, all farmers, you know, raising livestock, you know, for the most part are very much invested in the, you know, in the welfare of the animals that you know, they're responsible for. I mean, if you've, you know, spent any time with farmers, whether you're talking pork, beef, chicken, I mean, you'll hear that. But, you know, I think that, you know, especially younger generations, and I think with COVID being kind of a health-based, you know, issue that confronted the country, you know, I think there's been a lot more attention that's been paid to issues around animal welfare or, you know, the reduced use of antibiotics and those sorts of things across proteins. I mean, we've seen it with, you know, poultry industry is a great example, you know, significantly reducing antibiotic usage. And so, you know, I think these trends are all related. And I believe I believe it's going to continue. You know, it's not just California, you know, that's passed this kind of a measure. Massachusetts is on a similar schedule, you know, similar effective date with a very similar, you know, requirement from an animal welfare standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Mike Postian, conventional pork producers here in Iowa, what you mentioned a little bit about what you're hearing, but they may have to face the music that this is a trend larger than just California, as Chris just mentioned there. How are pork producers gearing up? Are they ready to change, give more space to the animals?
Oh yeah. It's constantly in flux and it's constantly changing, you know, and in some ways this is coming back around to, you know, when I was a kid, we had, you know, all our pigs were outside and, you know, it was much different than what it is now. And there were advantages to that and there were disadvantages. And, you know, we learned that moving pigs inside, allowed us to take better care of them in some situations, but you know, there again, there's pros and cons to that as well. You know, I think what it comes down to is, you know, producers work with, you know, swine specialists like at Iowa State, our veterinarians, to, you know, as we learn new things about what works and what doesn't work for caring for animals, you know, we're constantly changing what we're doing. And so, you know, I think a lot of producers are, you know, moving that way, but, you know, unfortunately, some producers who have already switched production methods or space standards based on, you know, requirements that other consumers have asked for, unfortunately, they still fall short of this new standard from California. So, you know, many of them are kind of wondering, well, what, you know, what should we do now? Because we already changed once and now we're being asked to change again. But, you know, I think producers are going to continue to adapt to the marketplace as they've always done. And if this, you know, if consumers, you know, want changes in production, you know, there is always going to be producers who are willing to step up and meet those new demands. You know, at the end of the day, though, I think it's important to remind everybody that, you know, of course, everybody wants to take good care of animals, but we also want to do it sustainably. And that means sustainably for the environment and also sustainably from an economic standpoint. And so, you know, we have to keep those things in balance. But, you know, it's something that producers have been doing for a long time, and I'm confident that they'll continue to adjust and adapt in the future.
We're running out of time. Quick answers, gentlemen, please, to the questions. Mike, to you first, back to you. What chances do you give this court action? The Iowa pork producers arguing in federal court that this California law would result in, quote, irreparable economic harm to Iowa farmers. Also, the federal act sponsored by Grassley and Ernst. Do you think this will be stopped somehow from taking place in a legal way?
You know, I really don't know. I think there are good legal arguments on both sides of the case, and so it could go either way at this point, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Chris Oliviero at Nyman Ranch, do pork producers, cattle producers such as Nyman Ranch that have higher standards in terms of animal welfare, are they positioned to benefit from this? Is this are you on the front end of this wave, so to speak? Will you benefit? Likely.
I believe that producers like Nyman Ranch, who are already, you know, already in compliance, and we're not the only ones, you know, certainly will. You know, we have a sister company, Coleman, that's been converting, you know, their program over to be compliant in order to, you know, to support this opportunity in the California marketplace. So, but again, I think it's very doable.
Mm-hmm. Chris, the word cruel has been used in this proposition. How do you define that in terms of hog breeding?
Yeah, look, my perspective is I don't think there's anything humane about, you know, confining an animal like a sow in a 2-foot by 7-foot crate, you know, for, you know, especially when we're talking the 4-month gestation period. I mean, if an animal can't stand up and turn around, you know, for me, and again, going back to the founding of this program, you know, that's something that we view as cruel.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, before we go, do you think in 5 years' time, your best guess here, a little bit of crystal ball going on, do you think this will be a turning point that will mark a change in consumers' attitudes, catch the attention of producers as well?
I think so. I the best parallel I think might be, you know, cage-free eggs. It started, you know, 10 years ago, and I think it's, you know, taken on a pretty significant portion of the total supply chain over there. So I think this is the start. I think there's other great examples, antibiotic usage in livestock as well being another one that you can draw some parallels to.
Okay, Mike Postian, the last word to you. What do you think will be thought of this point in time 5 years from now?
I think what it's really going to come down to is people. You know, it's easy to make rules about space requirements, but at the end of the day, humane treatment of animals comes down to the people. And so I think that's where more of the focus is going to have to be, is we need to make sure that everyone who's working with animals, you know, whatever the barn looks like, know how to best care for those animals.
Okay,
and,
Mike,
and, you know that.
Yep, yep, we have to go. Mike Postian joining us live from the Iowa State Fair, hog farmer based in Walcott, former president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. Chris Oliviero, of general manager at Nyman Ranch. Chris, thank you for joining us as well.
You bet.
When we come back, we continue our series, Leaving Afghanistan. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now we continue our series, Leaving Afghanistan. The goal of this series, to understand personal dimensions of the war by focusing on the individual experiences of Iowans who've really done all types of work in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. Of course, we thank them for their service and for sharing their experiences with IPR listeners. You can listen to all of the interviews in this podcast series and enjoy their photos that the vets have sent us and find out more by going to iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan. If you served in Afghanistan and you'd like to share your story on IPR, please email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. My guest today is Sean Vodnik. He's a native of Perry, Iowa, now a resident of Bondurant, a former member of the U.S. Army Reserve, also active duty Army from 2002 to 2007. He served then after that in 2010 and 2011 in Afghanistan as a military contractor. I spoke with Sean last week before the dramatic developments over this weekend. Sean Vodnik, welcome to our program, and thank you so much for your service, sir.
Thank you for the support. I really appreciate it.
Before we get into your mission in Afghanistan as a military contractor, because it's really interesting, you're the first of our interviews where we get to find out, we hear about them so much in the news, that military contractors, but actually, I think, probably know very little about what they actually do, what you actually did. But before we get to that part of the story, tell us a little bit about your military background, how you came to choose the military and your path.
Well, growing up in Perry, you know, back in the late 1900s, I loved G.I. Joe, and all my family members were prior service, and so it just kind of seemed like the thing I needed to do, and it was a perfect fit for me.
Mm-hmm. And you first joined the Army Reserve, and then went to active duty. Is that a usual path?
You know, we don't really have an active duty, environment here. There's no culture here for active duty, so we don't have an active duty base or anything like that. So I wasn't sure what I wanted to do in the military, and I thought I wanted to stay here in Iowa. So It seemed like a good fit to go into the Army Reserve or National Guard. I chose the reserve route.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to jump over quite a bit of your military background to get to Afghanistan, because that is later in your game in the military, so to speak. From 2008 to 2011, you were a military contractor, but you served, I understand, in 2010 and 2011 in Afghanistan. Tell us a little bit, well, first of all, about your mission and about what it means to be a military contractor in this context.
While I was in the military, I was a cavalry scout, so I was on Bradleys and everything like that. The individual that was my instructor on the Bradley actually connected with me once I got out and asked if I wanted a job to teach the Bradley. And so I jumped at that opportunity, and as soon as I met with his boss, they explained that the new MRAPs, or the Mine Resistant Ambush Protected Vehicles, were surging across Iraq, and they needed trainers for that. And I just said, yeah, I can do that as well. Didn't know what an MRAP was, but I'm sure I could figure it out. And after about 3 months of training, learning everything about that vehicle, between reading schematics and putting hands on the vehicle day in and day out, becoming a subject matter expert, shortly after that, went off to Iraq for a year. And then upon my return in 2009, I traveled all across the U.S. teaching it to Special Operations Command for their particular variant of the vehicle. And then in 2010, I went off to Afghanistan to become the site lead for Herat, and then I became program manager for the entire vehicle from Herat down to the Helmand province.
Interesting. Now, you're talking about the Bradley vehicle, the MRAP. I want to have you describe that. But before that, you sent us a photo, a few photos of the MRAP, I believe, in action on the Afghanistan landscape, and also you standing next to one, leaning against one. You seem to be instructing. You can, our listeners to podcasts, when this podcast is posted, can go to iowapublicradio.org/leavingafghanistan to find this photo. But tell us what you're doing. Is that the MRAP that the Bradley vehicle that you're instructing on right there?
That's correct. That is the RG-33 model of the MRAP. And there were close to about 12 different types of MRAPs, all different brands, all different contractors were out there teaching their variant of the MRAP.
Mm-hmm. And what is special about this vehicle? How did it fit into the overall fighting context of this war?
Well, it was a solution to the problem that IEDs posed. improvised explosive devices. So with a V-shaped underbody, it would direct the blast out and away from the vehicle, keeping the occupants inside relatively safe. There was just a constant change in the tactics that the enemy was using with the IEDs, and so the MRAP was the solution.
Mm-hmm. And you say mostly, so inside, if you're inside, I don't know if you've been in an MRAP when it's hit an IED, or can recount what that's like. I suppose it depends on the blast force of the IED, whether that fully protects the occupants.
Yeah, they're with the Humvee, that is completely flat on the underside. So when there was a concussive force of any substance, it would blast up and rattle the inside of the vehicle and cause a lot of internal injuries to the occupants as well. So with a V-shaped underbody, it would allow the blast to be directed out and away, as opposed to all that concussive force hitting directly underneath the occupants. So it was it saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is a vehicle that's armed well. It's an offensive vehicle?
Correct. It's used mainly for transport, but it will have weapons mount on the top as well that can hold a Mark 19 grenade launcher or M2 50 cal. Basically any crew served weapon can be mounted to the top of that.
Mm-hmm. In training, who are you training about the use of these vehicles?
All the U.S. Armed Forces, so Navy, Marines, Army, Air Force, anybody that's going to be operating those vehicles. We also had quite a few foreign troops, British and other allies would be receiving these vehicles as well, or be riding in the vehicles, and they wanted the training so they could operate it and if they needed to.
Mm-hmm. And when you were training them, what messages did you most want to get across to someone who was not acquainted with this MRAP, this Bradley vehicle?
I wanted them to be confident with the equipment. You know, if you're in a war zone and you just arrived, you hit the ground running, and now you're being issued this giant vehicle that is unlike anything that you've ever seen or ridden on or operated. So it was my job to help them gain confidence with the equipment, let them know why they want to use this vehicle and why it's better than what they're previously accustomed to with the Humvees.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if in your time training military as a military contractor in Afghanistan, if there's a day that stands out, a memory that stands out that you'd like to share, Sean.
Yeah, I was at a coffee shop in Afghanistan, and this young soldier comes up and, he said, "Mr. Vodnik, I just want to say thank you." And I was trying to remember where he was from, and then I recollected he was one of my first classes I ever had. And he said they were in the middle of a firefight, and I guess my voice just came on in his head on how to engage the four-wheel drive, what switches, which order they needed to go. And he said, "I could just hear your voice in my head as I was flipping those switches while everything else was rattling around us due to the gunfire."
Wow. And that must have been a great feeling.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that your voice was in his head. That speaks for your training ability, that you can react under pressure, and you hear Sean Vodnik, this Iowan's voice. If we have an accent, of course, Sean, we don't think we have accents in Iowa, but here,
well,
Sean's...
We don't.
We don't. We'll just say that right now. What a wonderful memory. What other memories do you have from this time?
Just the level of support, the camaraderie. I remember when I was a soldier in Iraq, and we always looked at the contractors as that that third person, that person that just makes more than us, that don't know quite what they do, and and whatnot. And then when I was in Afghanistan, it was a total flip, because now I am that person that I looked at as the third person. But the amount of support that we receive in Afghanistan from even the allies, the British military over on Camp Bastion, which is over in the Helmand province, they were just fantastic and supportive. They let us use their training sites for our training, and it was definitely that sense of one team, one fight. Everybody was in it together.
Mm-hmm. Sean, for our listeners, I want to remind our listeners, if they've just joined us, Sean Vodnik is with us this half hour, native of Perry, Iowa, now a resident of Bondurant, former member of served in the Army, U.S. Army Reserve, and we're talking more specifically about his time as a military contractor in Afghanistan for our series Leaving Afghanistan. So because you served in active duty in the Army and then became a military contractor, you got to see the flip side, as you said, and there are misconceptions about military contractors, and I'm sure they are communicated also through the popular media when has been reported on about Afghanistan or Iraq, that I think you just mentioned it. They're paid a huge sum of money, and they. What are some of the other misconceptions, or perhaps some of them are correct, others not?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that misconception that if you're a contractor, you're some sort of hired gun or some mercenary, and that's such a small contingent, a small fraction of the individuals that are overseas. Are supporting the war effort. Contractors run literally the base. Every base that you go to is swarming with contractors that do everything from sewage to trash pickup to food service to, in my situation, I was just I was an instructor. I trained military personnel on equipment. We have mechanics. We have everything that has to do with day-to-day life. Throughout Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere, you're going to find contractors there doing it.
Mm-hmm. And why do we need contractors doing all the work you described? Why not just regular military?
That's a very good question. I like to think that it allows the military to concentrate on the war effort. So, as contractors, our job is to support the war fighter, and so the military can focus more on the mission, on why we're there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the mission in Afghanistan has been a central focus recently as the U.S. is completing a withdrawal after 20 years of war there. What are your thoughts on this withdrawal and the rapid advance of the Taliban, the future of Afghanistan? It must give you pause and ask the question, was it worth it?
At the time, I believe it was. We did a lot of good there, and I think the good outweighs the bad of what we accomplished in every theater of operation that we've been in. As far as us pulling out, that needed to happen. We can't be there forever. 20 years is a long time to support another country, and I see it as if we've been training the Afghan military for 20 years, trying to build them up and get them the resources they need, the equipment they need, and now it's the ball's in their court. They need to get it together. And if they don't have the support of their own people, it's just apparently the people are choosing the Taliban. Is it out of fear? Is it out of what the Taliban offers and the government cannot? I don't know. That's way above my pay grade.
Yeah, you get the impression here that the government's corruption does not endear it to the people, and the Taliban, certainly an element of fear there in motivating people, but we're not on the ground and we're not experts about that. So let's move on.
Exactly.
Yeah, thoughts about the people of Afghanistan, their future, that could be very sad, tragic.
No, absolutely. War has been part of their life for longer than we've been there. Obviously the Soviets had invaded in the 80s, and they were there for a very long time. So war is just kind of part of their day-to-day life. What we consider to be just unbearable living conditions has been their life. They don't know any different life than what they've been living for the past 20 years. And when you really think about it, 20 years, of us being there, that means there was there were soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan that weren't even born yet when 9/11 happened. So mm-hmm. I mean, for them, Afghanistan was just something that has always been. And it's much the same with the Afghan civilians. It's just, you know, for a lot of the younger generation, having military, foreign military on their soil has just been their way of life.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts you had, Sean, specifically about Afghans who helped coalition forces, the many thousands, tens of thousands, now having fled or fleeing the country, in some cases for their lives, because they helped coalition forces.
Yeah, my heart goes out to them 100%. I do feel as if we just kind of abandoned them, which is really sad. That really hurts. I wish we could do more. I don't know what solution we could possibly provide, short of just bringing them over to America. But is that something that they want? You know, they worked really, really hard to try to secure a future for their own country. And you know, throwing in the towel, that would just be, yeah, my heart just goes out for them.
Yeah, and it really reminds us, doesn't it, of post-Vietnam, the civilians who helped Americans, American forces in Southeast Asia, and many of them have now for one, two, three generations have made their home here in the U.S. and specifically in Iowa.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, it would be wonderful if we treated the Afghan population the same way that we treated our allies in Vietnam. If we could just bring them over, that would be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned 9/11. You were at what point were you in your military career on 9/11, and where were you?
I was actually in Bosnia when 9/11 happened, doing peacekeeping operation over there. So. 9/11, the planes hit. I was on a convoy from Sarajevo to back to Eagle Base in Tuzla, Bosnia. And once we arrived, we had no idea what was happening. The base was locked down. We weren't allowed to enter. And the only answer we received was, you can't come on the base. America's under attack. I've never felt more powerless in my entire life. When you're told your home country is under attack, and that's the only information you've received, and you're in a foreign country helping another culture with their situation, providing peacekeeping operations. That's my heart sunk right there.
Yeah,
that was horrible.
As did all of ours, and there were so many questions in those first few hours, and now we've learned over the years since what actually happened in those first hours, and can be, I guess, thankful that it wasn't worse than it was, even though so many lives were lost and we began a whole new chapter here in the military. You were in the military. Once 9/11 happened, did you notice a different atmosphere, culture in the military after our country was attacked on 9/11?
Well, absolutely. Everything flipped into overdrive. We had all the resources that we needed to accomplish any mission that we were given, and the level of patriotism, the level of output and support that we had from everyone across the board, from civilians to military leadership, was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. A quick word, but before we say goodbye, about your time in Iraq, because that all U.S. forces are leaving Iraq as well. Tell us a little bit about your active duty there.
Yeah, I was there for the invasion of 2003, 2004, and when we crossed over into the border, we had just a lot of support from the local population. Everybody was cheering us, and it was pretty amazing. And that actually carried over into a little bit into 2004, but at that point, the insurgency was starting to really pick up, and that's when the threat was very, very real. Mm-hmm. And 2006, 2007, we were in Haifa Street during the Battle of Haifa Street. We did we went from 100% contact rate whenever we rolled out into sector to absolutely nothing. We pacified pretty much the entire area, and we couldn't have done that without connecting with the local population and getting their support and finding out who it is that is causing all the problems. And it really did take a village to help with that mission.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. Sean Vodnik, native of Perry, Iowa, now resident of Bondurant, former member, active duty member of the U.S. Army, U.S. Army Reserve. And we talked about today a military contractor who served in Afghanistan. Sean, thank you for sharing your experiences, and certainly thank you again for your service to our country.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.